Welcome to Linoleum Life, where things break.
Oh, man.
What just happened?
The shade just blew off the Christmas candle on the plate and the thing.
Did everything shatter into pieces?
Yes, you carry on.
Shall we pause the recording?
No, keep talking.
Well, while you're cleaning that up, you should also move that other plate that's sitting there, because that could easily also suffer the same fate. You see what I'm talking about?
This one?
Yeah, that one. Move it all. Move it away. Bring it to safety. No more everything dying and breaking in this house.
Podcasting!
Welcome to podcasting. This is a show called Linoleum Knife.
Where things shatter.
Where everything, yeah. What did I just say? I had this whole thing prepared. I was going to call us
we were misleading.
Misleading, ill-aimed, and clumsy.
Yes.
Well, clumsy is, clearly, is yes. Yeah. Hi. Welcome to us. That's Alonzo Duralde, the man who... you didn't actually break anything.
I didn't break anything. The window shade blew in.
The windows are open.
You're not pinning this on me.
Nice and warm day, and so we got the windows open and the wind blew.
We just
lost a plate.
Yes. I'm Alonzo Duralde.
And there was a Christmas tree candle on the plate that...
Don't judge us.
...didn't get burned down all the way
at Christmas
time. And so we occasionally still light it, like, because when you've got half of a Christmas tree candle...
You're not going to save it for next Christmas.
You're going to occasionally burn it. And it doesn't smell like anything. So we don't think to... Like, we light the scented candles, you know, for a pleasing thing for people to walk into the house to. Or for the bathroom. And the Christmas candle just sort of sits there and waits for us to remember to light it again.
It's the blobby bottom section of a tree.
Yeah, it just looks like a lumpy white... glittery thing.
Mm. It's like a goiter that you would light with a wick in it.
Yes.
Happy Christmas goiter, everybody.
Physical malady that you set on fire.
As in the olden times.
This is a podcast about movies.
Really, it is, we swear. I'm Alonzo Duralde, film critic for TheWrap.com and What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube. And that there is Dave White, who is film critic for Movies.com.
I gotta turn down my mic because I'm not there. I feel like I'm shouting into my own microphone. I'm shouting into my own ears. I know that.
Stop it.
I gotta turn off the tape player. You announced our names, what we do, what this is.
Yes.
Great. Now the
podcast can begin.
Yay, now the podcast can begin.
We went to a repertory cinema last night, which we don't get to do as often as we'd like, because too many of our nights every week are taken up with seeing, you know, what's Adam Sandler got coming to theaters? Yes. We need to go see that for our jobs.
Right.
So it was nice to actually go see François Truffaut's The Story of Adele H., which I'd never seen.
I had also never seen it. We were having this discussion out on the sidewalk in front of the New Beverly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm woefully underlooked when it comes to
François Truffaut.
Truffaut. I have seen The 400 Blows. That's it.
And now you've seen The Story of Adele
H. I've seen The Story of Adele H. And we were talking about that, you know, like, because I'm a big, obviously, anyone who listens to this knows, I'm a big fan of French film.
French films.
And of...
French fries.
And of the French New Wave, specifically.
Yes. Say it in French.
And Nouvelle Vague.
Thank you.
And I love Godard.
Mm.
And I was thinking about how they keep, you know, re-releasing Godard films, restoring them,
yeah,
and re-releasing remastering them, putting them back into art houses.
Yeah, we just missed the Le Petit Soldat.
Yeah, and they don't do that so much with Truffaut, and I think we were talking about the Something in the Air, a film we talked about last week.
Yeah.
One of the things that happens in Something in the Air is... the protagonists, they are really into film, obviously, and that was a thing that happened in post 1968 France and pre 1968, because films really did push a lot of the students into a revolutionary mindset, because the films were revolutionary.
Yeah,
they were introducing a new way of making movies.
Is that what? And what did you see the
documentary? Which is why the French New Wave is so important.
Yeah. Did you see the documentary about the guy, the Henri Langlois, or the American, yes, the Cinémathèque Française,
yes,
guy?
Yes.
And they talk about a lot about the sort of political,
yeah,
links between the, yeah.
One of the things they say in the film, someone accuses the other one of making films with an old fashioned syntax.
Right.
You know, revolutionary film needs revolutionary
language.
Language, yeah. Yeah. And so if you want to divide the French New Wave in half, you've got Godard, who became even more and more aggressive as time went on. Just ask people who saw Film Socialism what they thought of it. And you'll encounter some very strong opinions. But Truffaut, and I'm speaking as someone who only, you know, who has seen very little Truffaut, but has, you know, now seen Adèle H. and has read a lot about, you know, his style. He stayed sort of classical, you know. He made conventional films.
He's dismissed by the cool kids, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Because, yeah,
he shouldn't be dismissed.
No,
by the cool
no,
kids,
no, no, by no.
But that's what he did.
But yeah, I mean,
he went off and made regular movies.
Yeah, because Godard is still out there burning stuff down, and right, Truffaut, you know, as much as he's one of the architects of the French New Wave, certainly as a film critic, I mean, really, ultimately, when it got down to it, kind of wanted to be Howard Hawks, and there's nothing wrong with that. And so
the kids in Something in the Air would have definitely called his films,
yeah,
you know, counter-revolutionary.
Right.
By the time the early 70s came along.
Yeah.
Which is when Adèle H. was made.
Right. Well, mid-70s. But even...
74.
I thought it was like 75.
No.
Well, anyway. But even in the early 70s, he was already making films like, you know, Two English Girls, you know.
Right.
And The Bride Wore Black, which I'm sure, you know, was not the sort of thing that, you know...
Made you want to go spray paint anarchist slogans.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's a story of Adèle Hugo, the daughter of Victor Hugo. She's in love with a British military officer. At one point, they were thinking possibly that they would be married.
He clearly seduced her.
Right. And, you know, he's a cad and a playboy. An operator.
An operator type, as they would say in...
In Damsels in Distress.
Thank you. I can remember.
And it doesn't help her predilection toward her predisposition toward not predilection but her predisposition toward mental illness, which she'd have gone crazy anyway.
Right.
That just happened to be the thing that tipped her over the edge. So she loses her.
What I don't.
Which is, you're going to have to edit. You're going to have to bleep that word out, yes, that I just said.
Bad swear.
Bad swear.
The thing that I don't get about the movie, and I obviously will need to do more research into Adèle Hugo's life, but she was like 30-ish.
She was, yeah, in her early 30s all went down.
Because, you know, because the film very clearly
establishes. According to the film.
Yeah, the film says it's 1863, the American Civil War is raging because she's going to Canada to find this British guy, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end you see her tombstone and she was born in 1830. It's like, right. Wait.
And died in 1915, so she lived to be 85 years old. 85-year-old crazy lady.
Well, she got better. I'm sure. But the thing is, you know, so like here, okay, wait, in the 1860s, a woman in her mid-30s would be like an old maid at that point,
basically,
right? So here she is, like, you know, for one thing, Isabella Gianni, she ain't an old maid.
She was 19 when they made that movie.
And, you know, she's like throwing herself at this guy and you know, talking about how, you know, the promise is made and blah, blah, blah. And it's sort of like, so to find out later.
Let's be clear. He did her wrong.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, no question. Right. Yeah. No, we're not defending him.
Yeah.
And interestingly, the guy who plays the cad French or British soldier is Bruce Robinson, who went on to direct With Nell and I and How to Get Ahead in Advertising.
Yep.
And Jennifer 8. So that was a little cool little bit of film history I did not know.
He also wrote some books.
He did.
Yeah.
Those Brits, they all write books. They all experiment with bisexuality.
Yes.
It's a thing
all of them do.
Every single one of them. It's a thing they do.
Norman Parkinson.
Yes. Mick Jagger, Ben Cohen, doesn't matter.
The thing I was thinking, though, during the movie was that if Adele H. had lived today, mm-hmm. all she would have needed to do is write some really catchy kiss-off songs.
For Taylor Swift?
No, for herself.
Oh,
and she would be Adele.
Funny jokes. So,
a good movie. Good movie.
Good movie. Check it out.
Yeah. Filmed in 70s Brown-O-Vision.
Glumscope. By Nestor Almendros.
Yeah.
But
seriously,
yeah,
movies in the early to mid-70s, even up into the late 70s, they all had that same sort of, like, murk.
And depresso lux.
You know? It was brown. Maroon against brown against
blood.
Against, you know, gray.
Yeah. And you know, you can always tell a 70s period movie.
Well, yeah, because everyone looks like it's 1974, even though it's meant to be 1863.
And you can tell they're thinking, oh, well, we can do longer hair because we're doing, you know, period, blah, blah, blah. But they always do the wrong long hair.
It's very fluffy long hair.
Yeah, it's... and I like the
presence of blow dryers.
And the soldier guy has that valet who I thought was like another soldier but lesser rank. But then by the time they get to Bermuda or whatever, he literally is dressed like a bellhop.
Yeah. He's a manservant.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
But he was so, like, literally just walked out of Studio 54 or something.
Yeah, yeah. Crazy. The mustache.
Yeah.
The mustache is very Boys in the Sand.
Yeah, he was in an After Dark magazine cover shoot. Well, okay, moving on to...
Gay reference after gay reference.
which brings us to The Great Gatsby.
All the gay, yeah. Speaking of gay, there's The Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
So in the mid-20s, early 20s, when hip-hop reigned, rich people partied and got upset.
They partied in front of green screens, apparently.
And then they felt bad about love that they didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got drunk and had...
and they drove real fast in the taxi from Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
And then there was dubstep.
Yes.
And the end.
And then they wrote it all down in a sanitarium.
Explain what the story is about.
Okay. Well, you know.
I insulted Romaine of Derek and Romaine. Yes,
but thank you for Derek and Romaine for having
us on the show. Thank you for having us on the show. I'm sorry if I offended you. As I said, if you never went to high school, then you know the story. And she said, I never went to high school. And I said, well, when should you have gone to high school? And she said the 90s, and I said, then you've had time.
I told her she could polish it off, you know, on one long bus trip.
12 visits to the crapper, and you've finished The Great Gatsby. Yeah.
So for
one dozen poops
for them
equals one Great Gatsby.
For those of you who have been constipated or did not go to high school or whatever, it basically boils down to this. Nick Carraway comes to New York full of dreams, settles in a nouveau riche enclave of Long Island called West Egg. His neighbor is the mysterious Jay Gatsby, who throws nightly Bacchanals. And it, we find out later that he's doing all this to attract the attention of one woman, and that would be Nick's cousin Daisy, who lives directly across the bay in East Egg with her horrible rich husband, Tom Buchanan.
Extreme preppy.
Yeah.
The kind that thinks that there is no such thing as money because it's always there.
The kind of guy who makes up fraternity hazing rituals.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and it all goes very badly. The end.
And to evoke the spirit of the Roaring Twenties.
The excess.
Roaring Baz Luhrmann has made a roaring movie.
And roar and roar and roar it does.
I did not hate it because I'm a fan of his craziness.
You know what? I was until now.
I like the shallow opulence that he shows me. I like looking at it. I would go watch the first hour of this movie again just to watch
the stuff,
the crazy party scene stuff, just to watch them do the Charleston to house music.
So somebody was describing the scene where
Gatsby, that was exciting to me.
The scene where Gatsby is taking them on the tour of the house as being the equivalent to the James Franco "Look at my S."
Well,
from Spring Breakers,
we had this discussion, and that's where. That's where that came from. Franco's scene in Spring Breakers comes from The Great Gatsby.
Ah.
They're even standing on the dock in Spring Breakers, if you remember.
That's true, yeah.
That's all Great Gatsby.
Funny.
And so, no, it's not, I mean, yeah, one took from the other, but it wasn't Luhrmann taking it from Spring Breakers.
No. Right. Nor is anyone suggesting, just that it was an amusing parallel.
Well, it is an amusing parallel. Yeah. If they hadn't come out roughly the same time, the same year.
Yeah, Gatsby was supposed to come out last Christmas, you'll recall.
Yeah, people might not have, you know, got that, but that's, I mean,
here's the thing.
Obviously where Harmony Korine got that.
I like Luhrmann's sense of opulence. Yeah. You know, I like that he goes crazy with stuff, but I think that it works better when he does it with either paper thin stories like Australia or Moulin Rouge, or, you know, he gets away with it in Romeo and Juliet because that story has become so archetypal over the centuries that you can tell it you can tell it with seals if you want to.
And they have Romeo and Juliet :
Sealed with a kiss.
With a kiss, animated, what's the word? Boondoggle that I had to review a few years back.
Yes.
Anyway. Once you've turned it into West Side Story, you might as well make an animated film
with
seals.
Yeah, all bets are off.
So that's not a problem.
I feel like Gatsby is too intricate. And I don't know what the adjective here is, but it basically just, you can't dump all these things on top of it and have it come through.
I believe.
And it's like if you do a very delicate painted design on an eggshell, and then you dunk it in the pa's green dye for hours and hours and hours, the green eventually is going to cover it all up.
It's an interior sort of story.
Yeah.
It is not a huge exterior story.
Right.
The sequence in the book where Nick gets drunk for the second time in his life, here's what happens. He says, "I got drunk for the second time in my life on that day. And then everybody went out and got some more booze, and I sat around and I read a magazine." Now, in the movie... the guy playing a trumpet on the balcony on the fire escape, and
some guy painting
people nude flying around the room, and, you know, the more champagne just ejaculating at you. It's
in 3D, by the way, if we didn't mention.
It's crazy. And while the experience of that
drunkenness... It was like the spectacular number in Moulin Rouge.
While the experience of that drunkenness might have been wild, F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote it in a very
detached,
quiet kind of way, and so it's not a loud ass kind of story. But I get what Baz Luhrmann wanted to do here. I get that he wanted to explode everything. And my problem with this film is that happens for the first hour. And then the next hour and a half, it's like 2.5 hour movie. It kind of slows down, quiets down, and it makes its slow march to its unhappy ending.
Yeah, and he loves romances that end badly.
Yes.
And excess.
Yes.
So I'm sure on paper, he's like, perfect for me.
Perfect for me. My problem is that he was too faithful to that last chunk. Suddenly, I think he realized, like, oh, I actually do have to tell this
story,
this quiet story of unrequited love, where not a lot of stuff really happens. It's a lot of, you know, pining.
And one car accident.
And a car accident. And I've made this sort of tongue-in-cheek comparison this week, and I've said that it should have really just gone off the hinges like Demi Moore's The Scarlet Letter. You know, change the ending. Who cares, right? You've already
changed everything
else. You've already changed everything else. You've already made it into, you know, a spectacle on top of a spectacle. Why not do whatever you feel like doing to it? Why not change the actual story? Why not heighten it to the moon and back? Why not send them to Mars? Why not, you know, make aliens invade? Why not do whatever you feel like doing? You're Baz Luhrmann. Everyone expects you to do whatever you feel like doing. You've promised me excitement in the first hour of your film. I already know that the book, The Great Gatsby, is not super exciting. It's a classic of 20th century literature. It's a wonderful book. But it's not, you know,
action-packed.
It's not electrifying. No. And so, if you're going to be electrifying, do that. If you want to do it for 2 hours and 20 minutes, do that. Don't slow down on me, Baz Luhrmann.
Yeah, because the one thing I don't expect from Baz Luhrmann is to be bored. Like, I'm willing to let him do whatever he wants, right, as long as he keeps things hopping. But by the time The Great Gatsby builds to its sort of inevitable third act, you know, Tom Buchanan tells, you know, the mechanic things that are not true, I just remember thinking, oh, God, we've still got all this to go through.
Yeah. So, yeah, I am still a fan of Baz Luhrmann. I still am a fan of his hyper-artificiality. I think that the
artificial superficiality.
I think the artificial, I mean, I'm slapping my face because you put that word in my brain and it came out of my mouth. I think the novelty of all of these anachronistic juxtapositions, you've either got to take it to the next level.
Right.
Or pull back and go somewhere else. Because in the Moulin Rouge, when the guys are singing Smells Like Teen Spirit and, you know, the absinthe fairy is Kylie Minogue and she pops up and, you know, in a Tinkerbell sort of way you know, Ewan McGregor starts bleeding out these, you know, Elton John songs, and it's this surprise. It's a surprise.
Yeah.
I wanted surprise, but I knew going in what I was going to get. I knew that anachronistic stuff was going to happen.
Right.
And because I saw the trailer. And so they play that up heavily in the trailer. All that party stuff is all over the trailer. Furthermore, in the interim, other people have been biting your rhyme. Sofia Coppola did it in Marie Antoinette. Madonna did it when she directed W.E. It's all over the place now. It's a fun thing to do. It's the logical extension of the mashup phenomenon of 12 years ago. 12 years ago.
Yes.
And so, you know, push it forward. I expect you, Baz Luhrmann, to push it forward.
After you heard the first, like, 21st century song, did you even notice after that when they did it again?
Yes, through the entire film I noticed.
Because I felt like after the first one, it was like, okay, well, this is what it's going to be. And I stopped noticing. Whereas, like, in Moulin Rouge, it's like, oh, they're singing Celestial Spirit. Oh, he's singing your song. Oh, they're doing Like a Virgin. Oh, Roxanne. Like, it was, they right. were all,
no,
they were recontextualized in an interesting way. And here, it's just like,
here's another party scene where we're playing Florence and the Machine.
Yeah, it becomes aesthetic wallpaper.
Yeah.
Like, here's the thing, and here's that thing again, right. and here's that thing again, yes. you know. And it lacks any kind of, it doesn't mean anything, and it doesn't move you at all.
Right. I like the Hova bit in the speakeasy.
Oh, okay. And for
and you think it's racist.
I don't think that's racist. I think the way that...
No. I mean, you think the movie is racist.
You think the movie yes. is racist. Okay. I think, like, there's this weird thing where, like, he shoots black bodies and faces in a way that just sort of makes them this sort of weird, exotic furniture. In my review, I said it's like he's going to turn them all into mammy cookie
right.
jars.
Right.
It's creepy. And then, like, then there's the character of Meyer Wolfsheim, who is... from name to the context in which he's discussed in the book and in the film, clearly designed to be a Jewish. And he's played by this legendary Indian actor. Yes. And it's like, wait, what? Where did that come from?
I like that bit of casting.
Well, I would have liked that bit of casting if there had been some person of color in the film that was not just there to be a part of the set decoration.
Right. Right.
But given that he's the only one who has dialogue, it was kind of it just compounded this whole thing of what?
If the film is racist, it is blindly racist in that because that world did not include black people as protagonists, you know, in the world of rich white folks, they were automatically part of the scenery. And in the context of making the scenery shine and pop and look wild and exotic, he did do exactly what you were saying. He did that to the speakeasy dancers, to the butlers.
Yeah.
He cast people who specifically looked like they glowed. And then accentuated that with makeup and lighting right. and stuff.
I mean,
and
yes, so obviously I understand that there probably is not a single black character in the novel who has a line of dialogue.
No,
and I get yeah. the cultural context. And that's fine. And I, you know, but again, given that he's throwing everything else out the window
yeah.
and having Jay-Z producing the music and having
right.
this, you know, South Asian now playing a Jew mm-hmm. and all this other stuff, he could have made, you
we,
know,
we do reference
he could have
the
made
fact.
Jordan Baker black if he felt like it
yeah.
and nobody would have thought twice about it. But instead he has this very, you know, as you point out, I mean, this is a choice. This is not just something that accidentally happened. He went out of his way to create this sort of visual thing with
right.
these black characters, and it's weird.
No, it in hindsight, it is strange. In the moment, it is really just, you know, oh, here's another thing that looks cool and wild, you know. And aren't those speakeasy dancers, you know, badass looking? That was really what I thought when I saw the speakeasy dancers. And only after, when you said that to me, did I think, yes, perhaps you have a point.
Well,
we do hear from Daisy at the beginning where she discusses Tom's overt racism.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that comes up a couple times,
yeah.
the Negro Empire or whatever.
Yeah.
But the movie seems to underline that point in a way, in a weird way, whether intentional or not. Then, of course, the issue of the dancers, because, like most Luhrmann movies, this is edited with ADHD.
Yes.
Like, if they were dancing, I have no idea. Because it was just like...
Well, they were bumping and grinding.
Yeah, but you didn't get to see much of it, or not much of it, in a row.
It is suggested, and that is why... That's the outcome of this sort of editing, is that you might not see anything coherent from start to finish, but you feel as though you have when it's over.
It's as though
it taps into things you've seen before that he is referencing for that amount of time. You know, so you see basically, you know, a girl making her booty go pop, and you know what that is. And you've referenced that entire thing in your head already because you've seen 1,100 hip-hop videos like everybody else. Not you personally, you haven't because you hate music. But the thing is that, you know,
it's like one of those optical illusions where you see a bit of it and your mind fills in the rest of it.
His editing is meant for your mind to fill in the blanks. Ugh. And so, yes, I'd have to see it again to really, like, think on the racism situation. If it is probably actually maybe more racist than people are saying Spring Breakers is.
Yeah, at least those African-American characters get to talk.
Yeah, they have agency.
Yes.
And here, none of them do.
Right.
Except for maybe that trumpet player. He's got his own universe going on.
On, like, the fire escape.
He does whatever. He jumps from fire escape to fire escape.
Playing that trumpet.
Playing that trumpet for everybody to party with. They don't invite him in, but...
He is the party machine.
He is the party machine.
Which brings us to Peoples.
Peoples, which is not... Nia Peoples' party machine.
Sadly, no. But it's okay.
It is not a terrible movie.
No. Because Tyler Perry is presenting...
And producing.
But not writing
and directing. But not writing, or directing, or...
Acting.
And you can thank Jesus for all three of those things.
Jesus, who is also not mentioned in this film, which is how you can tell.
That's correct.
That Tyler Perry was not involved that directly.
They trick you, actually. You think it's going to happen right from the get-go, because Craig Robinson starts the movie singing a gospel-ish song to a room full of four-year-olds, but the song lyrics are, "Don't pee your pants."
Yeah, yeah. That's I forgot about that. Yeah, there is a good fake-out at the way up front. So this is basically
meet the parents.
Meet the black parents.
That's it.
Really. Yeah,
he even called, like, anybody who wants to make a joke about this movie. Craig Robinson makes the joke at the beginning and says he wants to meet the chocolate Kennedys.
Yes,
and so
because Craig Robinson, you know, sings kid songs. Maybe wants to be a child psychologist one day, and has been living with Kerry Washington, who's a lawyer at the UN and comes from this very fancy family. Her dad is a federal judge.
Yeah.
And so when he's planning to propose to her, she leaves for the weekend to go spend with the family in Sag Harbor in the Hamptons. So he decides to surprise her, and wackiness, as they say, ensues.
Yes.
But of the wackiness, it's mostly funny.
I will not say it is mostly funny.
It is more funny than not, is what
I'm
going to say.
It's halvesies kind of funny. Mm. It's the kind of funny.
53% funny.
I would say it's 53% funny.
Yeah.
It's enough funny where you're sitting through the entire movie going,
uh-huh. Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, I don't think I ever laughed out loud.
I did.
Like, uproariously.
My one favorite sequence is where they go to, like, to a grocery store, and Craig Robinson meets, like, several, like, older, like, in their 60s gentlemen.
You're right.
And finds
that
out,
is actually genuinely
finds really out they funny. Both used to date Kerry Washington, and he starts ribbing her about it, talking about how, like, well, he never dated Shirley Chisholm, and it's like, who else?
Or Harriet Tubman.
Who else did you used to date? You know, W.E.B. Du Bois or Benjamin Banneker? Du Bois, sorry, or Benjamin Banneker. And then he starts doing the Thriller dance.
Yes.
It's like, okay, this is funny, and this is, like, these are smart references.
Yeah.
You know, and they're smart black references, and I think most...
It is a film that assumes you have been in history class
and paying attention.
Yeah.
And the thing is that most of the films that we see that are aimed at an African-American audience primarily would not tell those jokes out of fear of not being understood. And it's like,
right.
You know, yeah. So right. It's exciting when they are.
No, yeah, it's the thing. You really, there's a danger in overpraising a film like this because it isn't so stupid.
It sucks way less than much of what we have to see.
And the things that are great about it are really great about it, like the fact that it's somewhat politically progressive, and there are lesbian characters who don't need a good man to set them on the right path. And
a funny sort of shout out to 70s, like, you know,
Amy Stewart,
LaBelle type, you know, like raunchy disco, and Craig Robinson like lip syncs a female disco number without it being like emasculating or the joke being on him for that. You know?
Diane Carroll plays the grandmother. Melvin Van Peebles plays the grandfather. You don't feel as though the folks making this movie were intentionally aiming to go lowbrow.
Right.
You feel like they really wanted to go somewhere that
Bill Cosby would not object to this
movie. not just because it's super bougie.
No.
Even though it is. Mm-hmm. I would have liked it to have been funnier.
No, absolutely.
Wittier.
I would have liked Kerry Washington's character to have been better written.
Right.
She's really a plot device.
She gets to have sex without repercussion. That's interesting.
Yes, definitely.
So, you know, you take the good, you take the bad, but it's 53% good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Craig Robinson, I think, you know, has it in him to be a leading man.
He's great.
He's really charming.
He takes even the dumbest thing and turns it into at least a physical gesture that is funny.
Right.
He's really talented and knows how to save weak material.
Yes.
And that's he carries the whole movie.
Well, I was going to say, also blessed with that skill is David Alan Grier, who plays the dad.
Right.
You know, who's basically doing his best sort of, you know, Lord Van Snootington harumph, you know, but he does it really well, and he makes it different from scene to scene. It's not just one long, you know, thing of exasperation or whatever.
The one thing I really, really wish, every time I see a movie like this that isn't Temptation, Confessions of a Marriage Counselor, anytime I see a movie like this with a cast of mostly not white people, it makes me wish that we had more black film.
Yes, no question.
Multiplexes. It makes me wish that there were films that were Latino in multiplexes, films that were Asian in multiplexes, and there just aren't very many, and the ones that we do get are frequently
awful.
Garbage.
Yeah. Because the thing, it boils down to, I actually did it.
Gay movies,
yeah,
same totally. Thing. Gay movies suck it.
I did
no pun intended there.
I did an article for this for Salon a few years ago about why are Latino movies so crappy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it comes down to the math. Like, you know, as a friend, I think it was Craig Chester said, 85% of everything is terrible.
Yes.
So it's a question of, like, having a big enough pool so that there's enough of that 15% that's worth watching. Because, yeah, we are getting the occasional Latino film, but it's like, you know, that thing that you had to watch with the Eva Longoria as the deadbeat mom.
Oh God, what was that called? That awful movie.
I don't even remember.
I can't remember what it was called.
Yeah, stuff like that. You know,
it was called Poop is what it was called.
But you know, every so often you get something like Jumping the Broom, or even like, you know,
I'll tell you what I liked.
The Think Like a Man.
Think Like a Man was really funny.
Had its moments, you know. So it's like, yeah, I would love to get more comedies like that. And that were, I love seeing movies where I feel like that we're eavesdropping on somebody else's culture. You know, I mean, whether it's foreign films or, you know, indie films from, you know, different ethnicities or whatever, you know. I like movies like that. I feel like I'm getting a different point of view and a different sense of humor, you know.
It's because you're racist and you don't have any friends of color.
Well, you know, I keep trying to have the one black friend that everybody has, but, you know, my application never goes through. I'm on the waiting list for the one black friend. Because every TV commercial, you know, has the black friend. I worked my way through college being the gay friend.
We're obviously to all of our friends of who are not white who are listening, you are our friends. Thank you for accepting our applications.
So yeah, so I wish there were more movies coming out of different communities that, you know, shared their funny stuff, you know.
Yes.
Or their sad stuff or whatever.
Yes. Know? Well, how many sad ones? Pariah. Is it, what else? Middle of Nowhere. What else?
Well, I don't know.
Those two.
Those.
Seriously.
A recent vintage. Yeah. You know, I'm sure if we thought about it, we'd come up with
more. And none of the Tyler Perry movies count.
No.
They do not.
Because they exist in their own universe.
Right.
I don't feel like they're reflecting anybody's reality, black or, you know, anything.
Yeah.
Just crazy town. also this week, Venus and Serena.
Which I half watched while you actually watched.
It's good. It's okay. I'm not a big sports
fan. It's very sweet. I love the footage of them when they're like 8.
Yeah, that's pretty hilarious.
They're so adorable when they're like 8 years old and they're playing tennis and their dad's like being real stern with them.
Yeah.
We're like, and what do you do next? And they're like, hit the ball, daddy. Yes, sir. Like,
yeah, it's very Tiger Woods.
You can tell he laid down the law.
Yeah.
that's a great Santini kind of father.
Totally.
Right there.
And, you know, and Serena apparently, you know, like Venus was the one who was like always groomed to be the superstar. And Serena was kind of the tag along. Mm. And then like Serena wound up, you know, being as good, if not better than her sister. And I mean, it's a fascinating story. I mean, obviously they're amazing. Their tale of rising up from the streets of Compton to, you know, international glamazons, you know, it's an interesting story. The movie is, you know, the movie is kind of like if you watch like a really long 60-minute segment, you know,
or on
like
how great somebody is.
Yeah,
that's
pretty much.
Basically,
they kind of touch on some dicey material, like this guy who was their coach from like 10 to 14, who now, you know, everybody pretends never happened. It's all been the dad. You know, he at least does get to speak a little in the movie,
right?
You know, and some familial tragedies.
It was
and whatnot.
Me. I did it. I helped.
Exactly. Over here, me! I was part of this. But yeah, it's very, they got a lot of, you know, they spent the entire year of 2011, the filmmakers spent 2011 with the sisters, and so they're in the hospital when Serena gets a clot in her lung, and, you know, stuff like that. But it doesn't really feel particularly revelatory. Of course, they're both Jehovah's Witnesses, so it's not like they got crazy scandals or
anything,
very, you know.
They're very straight-laced.
Yeah. So maybe that's, you know, there's only so much you can do with that.
They date a lot of hot celebrity dudes, though, both of them.
Really?
You saw, and they're like, they're all around all these guys, these like famous other athletes and musicians and stuff.
Just, yeah, but I'm sure they got a curfew.
You know what? they don't have curfews anymore. Self-imposed curfews,
They have a
probably.
Curfew from the Lord.
Self-imposed curfews.
From,
I'm sure.
From their Lord God Jehovah says you better be in by 11.
No, but one thing that's interesting about the way they were raised is that it became really internalized. And one of the things I thought was fascinating during the film was, you know, I didn't get to go to prom. Whatever. You know,
I was too busy winning the U.S.
Open. Look at me now. Prom schmom. And the other thing that I really liked was where they have clearly, both of them, decided that, you know, being obsessively great at everything that they try
is A-okay.
Is important. Like, that's never going to change.
I feel like anybody who spent their entire childhood, you know, like doing the work of adults, or at least super focused on thing, they snap at some point. You know,
Lindsay
Lohan,
will.
Michael Jackson, Tiger Woods. It seems like, I don't know. I mean, it hasn't happened to them yet, and
here's
I hope it never
the difference.
Does.
Here's the difference. Even though their dad was super driven and he pushed them really hard, it's completely clear from watching the film that they were also really loved and nurtured by their parents.
This is true.
And so it wasn't a stage mom, stage parent, you know, kind of sideline coach kind of parent thing where they were just like pushing the thing itself.
Yeah.
They were pushing the kids to be great across the board and also really caring for them.
No, absolutely.
You never get the feeling.
Parents come off, both parents come off. I mean, they're divorced, but they're still very close to the daughters. You never get the feeling that those kids
were damaged by any of it.
No, I don't think. I'm speaking in general terms. I just kind of feel like.
The religion is whatever it is. Who cares? But it's if you're gonna raise a prodigy and you're gonna be a hard ass on that kid,
right?
Honestly, the way their dad did it is kind of the looks like it's a good way. Mm-hmm. You know, you push them. You see they have a little bit of talent.
Yeah.
You push them on that talent. You drill that talent into them by any means necessary, and also, you know, hug them. Tell them they did a great job when they do a great job. You know,
one thing the movie does really well is sort of contextualizes the phenomenon of the Williams sisters in the various different arenas in which they have succeeded. So Chris Rock talks about them in terms of race.
Yes.
Anna Wintour talks about them in terms of what they've done for the world of fashion. Mm-hmm. You know, people like McEnroe and Billie Jean King are talking about them in terms of tennis. And they really kind of point out, like, Serena has had her occasional moments of outburst on the court, yeah. You know, yeah, with, like, yeah. line judges. And even she says, like, I insult them in the most nerdy way possible. Like, where I told the woman, right. you're ugly on the inside. It's like, right. I would have gotten beaten up in high school for saying that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But like just the furor caused by that, as opposed to like McEnroe, who is just, you know, bananas.
He's profane.
Yeah,
his entire life.
Practically had Tourette's, you know. Yeah. And then he's like, you know, whatever. So it's like, you know, he's a dude. He's a white dude. You know,
he can say and do whatever he wants. Yeah. And the level of scrutiny endured by anyone who is not
a white guy,
a straight white guy,
yeah.
in the world, is a punishing amount of scrutiny.
Yeah.
It's an almost prohibitive amount of scrutiny.
Right.
And unless you have a very sturdy spine,
yeah.
it can knock you down. I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And these two women are made of iron. Even just sitting here at the dining room table, kind of half watching it,
uh-huh.
I just, you know, I barely pay any attention to tennis. But by the time it was over, if you're going to make, you know, hey, geography, make one that makes me really happy. Like, by the time you finished watching it and I was sort of doodling around on the internet and drinking mm-hmm. tea, I was like, I love them.
Yeah, you really do come up at the end of like, they're amazing. So it is opening this weekend. It's also on demand, so yeah. You are... have lots of opportunities to see it if you are into that sort of thing. You know, might even be enjoyed more by people who know less about them, because I think if you're already a fan, you might not necessarily learn anything.
Speaking of things that are on demand, Upstream Color is now on demand.
Mm, okay.
We talked about that a couple weeks ago. You see it, go, if you don't live anywhere near, it's already out on DVD and Blu-ray too. Right.
Now, it is still getting around. I got some tweets this weekend yeah. from people who were re-listening to the show to hear what we had to yeah. say about it, and somebody who I think went in Minneapolis. and Shane Carruth was there doing a Q&A.
Right.
So it's still getting around. So if it's going to get near you where you can see it in a theater, especially a really good theater with an amazing sound system, hold out for the big screen. But if not, yes, by all means, download
DVD,
it.
Blu-ray, on demand. The other thing that is now on demand right now, starting this week, uh-huh. is what I just talked about earlier, Olivier Assayas's Something in the Air.
Mm, right, yes.
Which, again, brand new into theaters, will probably make its way through to some theaters. If you can see it in a theater, see it in a theater.
That
but
one
it's on
is,
demand right now.
That one probably translates better into watching at home. At least, I mean, it's...
But it's really beautiful looking.
Sure. Yeah,
and
no,
always not. Feels better in a
obviously,
in a movie
whenever you have the choice, the big screen is better. But yeah. but for those two movies, Upstream Color is more vital that you see in a theater if you can.
Yeah. No One Lives.
Yes.
Which
I did not see.
Stars.
And I do not regret it.
It stars, well, first of all, it is its title.
So it's not like John Dies at the End.
No. No. No, it is actually a little bit like John Dies at the End, because almost no one lives.
Uh-huh.
You know.
No one lives. I don't know.
It stars...
No one lived.
It stars the inscrutable Luke Evans.
You may recall him as being gay and then not gay.
He's the British actor who came out as gay about 10 years ago.
When he did, was in Taboo on Broadway.
When nobody knew who he was at all. And he was like, yeah, I'm a gay actor. Like, it's at the very beginning of his career, and he was sort of like, I've got nothing to lose. You know, I'm not going to be in anybody's box, you know, for my entire career, because you can't, you know, you can't do anything mean to me if I already tell you I'm gay right from the get-go. And now he's got career heat.
Yes, because he was in Immortals.
Immortals and The Hobbit and...
The Titans, one of the Titans.
Clash of the Titans. So, like, he's got an action career... A genre career going.
Now he ain't gay no more.
No, he's not gay anymore. He's officially no longer gay.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what's funny about this, before we talk about the movie.
Everything
too much,
is funny
about this. I mean, first of all, yes, everything is funny about this. But what I find most interesting about the way this is being handled is not that, all right, let's go back 10 years ago or however long it was, 11 years ago, where he says, yeah, I'm gay. And then a few years later, when he says, I'm so gay, let me tell you what kind of gay porn I like.
Yes.
Like, he said that in the press.
It wasn't like it was a vague quote that you could backpedal from. Yeah. Like, he was full tilt boogie.
I'm such a gay that I'm going to talk to you about gay porn.
Here are my five favorite taints. I mean, it was that kind of like, and, you know.
But, so that level of forthright speech suddenly becomes this weird, retreaty kind of...
1984 rewriting.
Yeah. Where it... He could have saved the whole problematic mess by saying, you know what? 10 years ago, I came out and said I was gay. But here, along came this woman. And I found myself in love with her. So I guess that means I'm either maybe not so gay, or maybe I'm bisexual, or
I'm
whatever.
Coming.
I'm dating a woman now, so you can't label me.
Right.
I will decide who I'm going to love when they come to me and I fall in love with them. And
I don't believe in labels.
I don't believe in labels, man.
I fall in love with the person.
I'm post being, you know, you can't fade me, bro. Like, you, whatever, you gotta say.
I'm like the wind.
Yeah. Be that.
Yeah.
But that's not what he did.
No.
What he did was everything got erased.
Yeah.
Except it is the internet and you cannot erase exactly. anything from the internet. So the publicists are being weird and they're saying, like,
he never met that.
He is only concerned with his family and his career and we will not speak of the word that begins with the G and ends with the Y. We don't know this word. It is not a word we have ever heard. You know.
Go about your business.
That's, yeah. It's like, these are not the droids you're looking for. There's nothing normal or organic about this process. And so, I'm sorry, dude. You're doing it wrong.
Yeah, if
you are really in love with this chick that you've been linked with, and it's someone else who's quasi-famous,
right?
And I'm blanking on who she is.
If you're gonna sell us a bill of goods, sell it right.
Do it. Yeah. Just say, look, I thought I was gay, now I'm in love with a woman.
Yes.
Whatever, man.
I've blossomed.
Yeah, Greg Araki did that. He's a well-known gay filmmaker, and boom, he turns right around and hooks up with a female actress for a few years.
Yeah,
like, they were a couple, a real couple.
Right.
No fakes, no backpedaling, no...
No take-backs.
No take-backs. I'm not gay anymore. What? I never said I was gay.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? I never directed films about gays.
Exactly.
Can you... That would be like if he had tried to do that. No, all he said was, I'm in love with her.
Yeah.
She's in love with me. Get off my back.
Right.
That's all you got to do.
And then it ended, and he went back to dudes, and that was it.
We assume he did. I don't know what he did.
He did.
Okay. Well, anyway.
Luke Evans.
This movie is some bollocks, speaking of British things. Directed by, and now I'm going to blank on his name, the man who directed Midnight Meat Train.
Yes.
He's
leaving on that Midnight Meat Train to Georgia.
The awesome Midnight Meat Train.
Leaving on the Midnight Train.
This is not Midnight Meat Train. It wishes it were Midnight Meat Train. It's about a guy, Luke Evans, who kills people. Ta-da! That's what he does. In the course of killing people, he kills them in occasionally interesting ways. WWE personality Brodus Clay is in the film. It's from WWE Studios. He is, spoiler, killed in a cool way.
Ryuhei Kitamura?
Yes.
Ryuhei Kitamura.
Yeah, director of Midnight Meat Train. Correct. And Versus and something else I'm blanking on. Brodus Clay is killed, one of the first people killed in the movie, and killed in a cool way, and then a really cool thing happens to his body, which I would watch this on cable and fast forward to that part because of the cool thing that happens with his corpse. Another cool thing happens to another corpse later in the film. It's really gross, and it's really awesome. That's kind of it. That's kind of everything that happens in this film. Mm-hmm. It stars Adelaide Clemens as the last girl. Mm-hmm. She's also the first girl, by the way, because she's running from Luke Evans in the beginning of the movie. He's already been chasing her. She was already the survivor of a mass killing that he perpetrated. And then he runs into another mass of people that he slaughters left and right while she keeps eluding him. Mm. And so she's an Australian actress, dead ringer for Michelle Williams and Carey Mulligan. Like, if those two made a baby, it would be her. She's also in Great Gatsby. I would
say she's opposite Carey Mulligan in the Great
Gatsby.
She's
got a big week right now. She's got two movies that open on the same day. It's just such a...
She's the Jessica Chastain of crap.
Such a useless movie this is. Not cool, not scary, not funny. A couple of moments of cool gore, that's it. Mm. If you love the gore like I do, watch it on a DVR, fast forward to those parts.
Now, before we get into DVDs and letters, somebody pointed out on Twitter recently that we have a bad habit of saying, like, when a new movie comes out and there's a big spoiler thing that we don't want to talk about, and then we say we'll circle back around and get to it when it comes out on DVD, and then we never do. So, to fix that, I thought...
Well, to take a step in the direction of fixing
that. Well, okay, to
all is not going to be
to begin
eradicated
to begin the process of ameliorating right. the situation.
Yes,
I thought we might spend a couple of minutes talking about the thing in Django Unchained Chain. That we did not talk about when the movie came out, now that it's on DVD. If you do not want to know anything about what we're about to give away...
Turn it down for the next 2 minutes.
Give us 2 minutes. Okay.
Go. Starting now.
Yeah.
All right. Sam Jackson's character is Leo's personal slave.
Yes.
Okay.
Literally.
His personal manservant. Right. All right. And whenever public is around, whenever company's around, whenever anyone else is around, Sam Jackson talks like he's on Roots. That old-fashioned
servile,
sort of, you know, yassa, massa, this, yeah. Thassa, you know, that kind of thing. And then, when it's just him and Leo in a room together, he's the boss.
He is Shaft.
He is the boss.
Yeah.
His tone of speech changes. He begins speaking like
succinctly and clearly.
Like
and dominating.
Like the white majority, essentially.
Right.
And dominating Leo. Essentially telling him how things are going to be and how the world is going to be.
Right.
How what he should do next.
Yeah.
And Leo obeys mm-hmm. him. Now, and that's curious until, unless you put it together with a scene that also happens at Leo's plantation, where he talks about the magnetic pull of black love, and how you can't you can't extricate yourself from it once you've had a taste. So this is the thing: he and Sam Jackson are lovers.
I think that's a valid theory.
And Sam Jackson is the top.
But that too, yeah.
Not just the top, but all the way.
Yeah, if A, then B,
like,
for sure.
The boss of, like, right. He's the king of Queen Leo's world.
Okay, time.
then.
Yes, I think that is a valid theory, and yeah. I didn't think of it at the time, but as soon as you said it, I was like, oh, yeah.
The minute it started happening in the movie, I thought, oh, that's what's happening.
Yeah. And when I'd say other scenes, certainly back that up.
Yeah.
So. All right, so yes, we'll try and do more of that.
Yeah.
If there's other ones. I know we did
maybe
that.
Maybe we'll try to do more of
we
that.
We did Cabin if in the Woods, get around but to it, maybe. I forgot what we were even
way
talking
too long
about,
ago.
So, yeah. But anyway, if it comes up again, call us on it. We'll do better. Okay, DVD pick.
In conjunction with No One Lives, as sort of an excited preparatory action before I watched No One Lives, I cut my hand in the sink washing a glass. I had my hand. I have very little hands. I'm not a little man, but I have little boy hands.
True.
And I had my hand entirely in a glass, you know, sponging out the inside of the glass, and I expanded my hand a little too much, and I shattered the glass and sliced up my hand, and blood went everywhere, and it was pretty great to watch.
It's worth noting you've done this before.
I have done this before, and it required stitches.
You called me when I was at the Advocate, and yeah. I had to come home and get you and take you to the ER because yes. you were bleeding.
So that was a great day because I had never had stitches on anything in my whole life before. And I got to watch the doctor stitch me up. I requested a pillow so that I could have my head elevated so that I could see this happening.
You are one sick puppy.
And I this did not require stitches. It was a very light sort of cut. But I did slice myself enough that blood was spraying out of my head. So I had to, you know, I had to like makeshift tourniquet myself with a dish rag and hold my hand up and go wash it and alcohol and hydrogen peroxide and Neosporin and the Band-Aids. And because of this and because of my earlier experience with going to stitches, it just reminded me again of one of my favorite French movies of the past 10 years by a filmmaker named Marina Devan, and the name of the film is In My Skin. And I'm feeling a sense of deja vu as I talk about this because I have a feeling that I've recommended this DVD before on the show.
And you bring it up a lot in general. So
in the process of archiving our DVD recommendations and our music intros, I have yet to come across this as a recommendation. That doesn't mean it hasn't happened. I just haven't got to that episode yet. I may have well have recommended this film before, but it's about a woman who accidentally gouges her leg in a backyard accident at a party and becomes obsessed with the wound to the point where she begins cutting and mutilating herself obsessively. And then it becomes a sexual obsession, to where she can only become sexually sort of into herself when she's bleeding.
Never seen this movie. I don't know that I have
so
it in me.
Great.
To get through it.
So cool.
Didn't Francois Ozon like executive produce it or something?
I think he may have. But if, you know, get a chance, seek it out. It's gross, and I highly recommend it.
It's out of print. I'll see if they've got it on Netflix.
I don't think it is out of print.
I just looked on Amazon.
I looked on Amazon earlier, and you can get copies for sale.
Yes, that doesn't mean it's in print.
Oh, well, whatever. It's easily gettable if you want to buy it. And I have two DVD recommendations this week because it's Mother's Day.
Yes, it is.
And my DVD recommendation in honor of The Great Gatsby and in honor of Mother's Day is Baz Luhrmann's Australia. Probably his worst reviewed film, even worse than the reviews that Great Gatsby is getting, and considered by most to be his biggest sort of debacle. But my mother loved it. My mother loved Australia. I took her to see Australia when it came out into theaters, and Australia is a very long film. Well over 2.5 hours.
Yes.
And you know, my mom had had a stroke, and she lived in a nursing home. So I would wheel her out to the rental car, and I would get her in the front seat, and I'd put the wheelchair in the back, and we'd get to the movie theater, and I'd take the wheelchair out and put her in the wheelchair and roll her in, and we'd put her in the handicapped spot, and I'd sit next to her. She loved going to the movies. She always went to the movies with me when even before the stroke. Here's the thing about people who have strokes, though. They need help with going to the bathroom and things sometimes. And my mom was always very good about, in the middle of a movie, tapping my leg and saying, m-m-m-m-m-m, because the stroke took her speech away. She vocalized, but did not have words anymore. But I knew what she wanted. She would hit my leg and go, m-m-m-m-m-m, and I'd say, do you need to go to the bathroom? And yeah, so we would. She didn't hit my leg to go to the bathroom during Australia. Instead, what she did was, the minute Hugh Jackman shows up at the party, the great romantic climax mid-film, where you realize that Hugh Jackman and Nicole Kidman are really going to get together. She's in this stunning red dress at this big ball, and he shows up in a tuxedo, and he looks like $1 million for the very first time in the film, because he's this worker dude, you know?
The drover.
And my mother starts slapping her own leg and shouting at the screen with excitement because she's so swept up in this moment of these two people to being in love. She hits her own leg a million times and she's like, mama, 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 like just cheering the movie and crying. She's so moved. She's crying too. And then she wet her pants.
Which is like a standing ovation.
Really. She had done this before in another film. If you listen to the Unfictional show on KCRW, I once told the story on that about the very first time my mother wet her pants at a movie. And it was a source of great shame and humiliation for her that very first time. Like, it was this big turning point where she sort of realized, oh, God, I need help all the time now. And this is going to be something that happens to me. And when it happened to her, I did my best to make her feel like it was no big deal. You know, it was just a thing that happened.
Sure.
And by the end of that experience, she had sort of chilled out a little bit, not much. But it took her a while to really sort of calm down about it. Eventually, she became very blasé about it and was like, yeah, someone just changed me. So just come, like, ring the bell. You know, it's happened again. And but actually, by the time we saw Australia, she had wet her pants, and you know, I took her to the bathroom. We always carried an extra pair of pants at this point to change into something dry, and it took like a good 10 minutes. You know, we had missed some things in the movie. Fortunately, I had seen it in a reviewer capacity, so I was able to fill her in. But when it happened, I said, are you freaked out? Do you want to leave? And she's like, mom, like shaking her head no. Like, she, get me changed as fast as possible in the family restroom and get me back into that theater.
I'm missing Australia.
I'm missing Australia. Damn you.
My mother
loved that movie.
I have always defended Australia because I think it is... It traffics in these sort of like great kind of hokey old movie tropes, you know, and you know, that didn't hurt Titanic. I don't know why, you know, it didn't translate here, but yeah, it's two or three movies glued together, granted, but it's still, it's a movie I like, it's fun.
Speaking of my mom, just one more brief thing, today is the very first Mother's Day since my mother passed away, and I, in an effort to deflect attention from this, because I've already been through the condolences of everybody.
You've been condoled.
I've been condoled frequently and often, and I appreciate all of those things. I love everybody who loved all the stories I've written about her and blah, 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 all that stuff. So today, instead of posting a picture of my mother on Facebook, which everyone has done today, I posted a picture of the Partridge Family board game playing piece with Shirley Jones, and all that, just her head, she's singing with the big wide open mouth, and it just says, Mom, underneath it. Like, the weird thing about the Partridge Family board game is that all the characters in the board game are like, Keith, Lori, Danny, and they just like, Mom. Like, they don't go like, it's not even Shirley. You know, it's
look, it Mom. All came together when Mom sang.
I know, but she didn't even have a name. It's just Mom. And I just thought it was really funny, and I took a picture of it. I thought, I'm going to use that as my Mother's Day post. All it did was spark people saying, oh, I'm so sorry, Dave. Like, don't be sorry. You didn't kill her. You know, 8 years of a stroke did, you know, so.
She had a good run.
She, yeah. But anyway, that's what happened today on Facebook. Like, it's better to just retreat and do nothing.
Apparently. Yeah. There's no getting around. Well, my DVD pick also ties into Mother's Day, and it's one of my favorite movies of all time, and it's Pedro Almodovar's All About My Mother.
Yes.
Which is a great movie about...
A great movie.
A great movie, period, but it's a great movie about mothers and about actresses and about... all kinds of things. And if you've never seen it, you ought to should. And if you have, you ought to see it again, because it's great. Letters. What do we got?
Are you hot? It's real hot in here. I know the fan is on and everything.
I'm not uncomfortable.
I feel like Gwyneth Paltrow at the Met Gala.
I don't even know what that means, but...
Did you not hear about that? No. This week, she said she's never going back. The Met Gala, for the costume ball.
Really?
She said it was unfun and boiling hot.
Wow.
And you know what? I bet it was. I bet it was unfun, and I bet it was boiling
hot. She's going to stay home and make mango quesadillas instead.
Yes.
With almond cheese. Thank you to Joe, by the way.
Both Gwyneth and I hate places that are not sufficiently air-conditioned.
Who sent me Gwyneth's cookbook. As a birthday present.
I'm glad it was your birthday present, but I'm stoked about this cookbook. I've been reading through it all week, and everything in it looks delicious.
I haven't had a chance to.
Most of it is vegan
the
stuff.
The New York Magazine lady loves it, just it's all expensive to make.
I haven't found expensive ingredients in there yet.
All right.
No, oh, we know who you're talking about. The funny sort of tongue-in-cheek article. Well, in that, she's like, do you know what raw honey is? Raw honey is $11. You know what? It's not.
It's only six.
When you go to the farmer's market.
I know.
Buy it from the lesbian honey grower lady. It's raw honey. It's $6. Big jar.
Find your own lesbian.
Don't go to the you know what,
apiary
is. If you're shopping at the boutique market.
Well, yeah, at Dean and DeLuca, it's $11 in a smaller jar than you get, probably.
Yeah. Anyway, here's a letter to Alonzo. Don't call me Alfonso Duralde. And Dave, it's so cold in the D. White.
I was called Alfonso by the LA Times this week.
Yes.
Excitement. Go on.
During your discussion of Upstream Color a few episodes back, the two of you mentioned your disdain for critics referring to a film as pretentious, and I was wondering if you might elaborate on this point. Is it because the pretentious label is all too often a lazy shortcut for I didn't like this movie, and I can't quite tell you why, so let's call it pretentious? Or is there a deeper problem with the concept of pretentiousness itself and how it relates to film criticism. I'm sure we've all sat through a film and found ourselves rolling our eyes and thinking, my God, what a pretentious piece of bleep. Are reactions like these merely too surface level and vague to include in a review, i.e. just bad writing? Or are they fundamentally wrong in regards to our criticism of film in general, i.e. just bad thinking? Thanks, Evan. P.S. I bought the new Ghostface Killah CD the other week, and I was given a free cassette version of the album with my purchase. Naturally, it made me think of Linoleum Knife. I think it is bad writing and bad thinking.
Yeah, I mean, pretentious is a tricky word, because what are you really saying? I mean, are you saying that the director is aiming over your head and how dare he? Or that the director is... aiming over his own head and how dare he? You know, it's a vague term, and I think that you can nail it down more specifically without just sounding like you are yourself an anti-intellectual boob. Because I think that's what when you say something's pretentious, it's like saying, oh, that girl's so phony.
Right.
You know, it doesn't mean anything. Like, you know, you need some concrete examples, and once you get the concrete examples, you can nail down what exactly you're objecting to.
With a movie like Upstream Color that is so
challenging
and sophisticated in its plotting and its detail and in what detail it intentionally chooses to leave out.
Right. And its refusal to sort of hew to traditional narrative.
Right. And on top of that is so elegantly constructed, you know. To call that pretentious is really your problem. I've seen pretentious, and 99.99% of the time, it is ham-fisted and showy.
Yeah.
A lot of stage productions that I've seen, you know, a lot of really low-budgety sort of film festival submissions that I've seen in the context of watching them along with you.
You and I would disagree, but I would say that some of the early films of Harmony Korine, Traffic, in a kind of showy. Either violation of narrative or
we're not going to go down that road right now because you're completely off the mark. Yeah. But it is almost always clunky and showy and not smart. You know, it in a way that is sort of calling attention to how smart it is, and watch enough of this stuff, and you can see it when it's happening. But this is not it. Upstream Color is not it. And other sort of like really, really challenging films are not it. Because what you are saying when you out of hand just throw the word pretentious around is that I'm the only one that can see through these, you know, these falsehoods. I'm the only one that's willing to be brave enough to say that the emperor has no clothes. You know, screw these other, you know, smart writers who are telling me, you know, that this is what they saw, and I alone am the one who's going to rip the lid off of this.
It's not to say that pretension doesn't exist, but I think the word has become so devalued that you are sort of forced to kind of, and I think you should be forced anyway, to back it up with something.
Yes.
And point out what you see as being, you know,
false.
Sort of showy flim-flam,
yeah.
As opposed to a legitimate, you know, aesthetic choice.
Yeah, honestly, if we're going to go with the old-school definition, anything of value has some pretense to it.
Sure.
Because they've got something to show you, they've got something to prove, they've got something that they want to, you know, get across.
Yeah. So you can think that something is pretentious, but if you're going to describe it, then you need to go into the weeds a little and you know, show your work.
Right. All right.
Good question, though, Evan.
I'm going to go with this next shorter letter. And once again, I'm very sorry, Ben. I'm going to bump your hugely long letter to next week. And we are going to only read your letter next week.
Okay.
I made a mistake. I think I said this very thing last week.
Okay.
I made a mistake this week, and I started with a short letter, and I've got another short letter.
Maybe even earlier in the episode.
Maybe.
Just get it out there.
Yeah. Okay. My name is Maria, and I'm a huge all caps fan of your podcast, and I enjoy listening to it every week. I don't mind that you guys get sidetracked or that it takes around 10 to 20 minutes when you guys start talking about the movies.
Thank you. We don't mind either.
I'll scroll down here. I'm wondering if I should go up. I'm sorry. Before you guys start talking about the movies that I'm interested in seeing and wondering if I should go to that movie or not, because I respect your opinions.
Well, alrighty.
As you should. I finally mustered up the courage to email you guys my top 10 list. Please don't be harsh on me in no particular order. Number one, it's a three-way tie.
Oh, cheater.
Well, not really.
Okay.
Howl's Moving Castle, Kiki's Delivery Service, Spirited Away.
Okay.
She goes, these are the Studio Ghibli movies I've seen so far. I love them.
Okay.
You get a pass.
Yeah. They're not equivalent, but fair enough.
The Lion King. No.
No. But then again, you know, if you were like...
If you were young,
you were 8 years old in 1995.
Talk to PW.
Exactly. Yeah,
talk to PW about The Lion King.
You were ingrained.
He was four when that movie came out and watched it on VHS over and over. And
exactly.
He's 25 now.
I'm going to give you a pass on that one just because I think it's the unification church of a generation.
Right. The Holes. Did you still have not
seen
Holes?
I've never seen Holes, but I hear it's great. Really great. I hear it's fun, yeah.
Skyfall.
Sure.
Yeah. Quinceañera. Not into it.
Not a fan.
Yeah.
If your name is Maria and you like it, I will trust your judgment on this one.
Dumplings. Have you ever seen Dumplings?
No. Is it like a horror movie?
She just saw this on the Epix drive-thru one time, and I loved it. One of those Chinese cautionary tales. This movie's about a former soap opera star who decides to get help from a witch doctor so she can look young. Oh, wait, you know what? This was a short film that was turned into a feature, I think. Maybe I did see this. This is ringing a bell. Again, the wheel of memory that requires me to go back and look at things. I look at reviews of movies that I forgot I've seen.
Yeah, 2004.
Yeah. Go to a witch doctor so she can look younger, so she can be attractive to her husband again, who is having an affair with his younger assistant. Warning, don't eat while watching this movie. I've seen the short version, I know that. There's okay. a short film version of this, and I totally know. And yeah, even the short version is not for the squeamish.
Okay.
Slumdog Millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
Eight is another two-way tie. Bridesmaids and 21 Jump Street. Number nine is Borat.
Okay.
Number 10 is two concert films from the White Stripes. Under Blackpool Lights and Under Great White Northern Lights. I have seen neither of these.
Me neither.
Although I did like the White Stripes when they were around. Mm. I'll give you the benefit of the doubt on these.
Okay.
So what are we doing for her? We're
I'd say 95. I'll give her half off for Quinceañera and half off for The Lion King.
No, no. Neither one of us like Quinceañera.
Okay.
Yeah. You're 85% knife. How's
Ooh,
that?
Ooh, that's scorching.
That's not scorching.
Well,
that's
okay.
one
you're
off
right,
and a half
you're
off.
Right, you're right. Okay, 85.
That's
still, it's,
fair.
A, it's still a B plus.
Fair. Fair. It's a nice, solid B.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. You're 85% knife, Maria.
All right. Well, here's... She has some honorable mentions.
Oh, okay.
That I think should be read.
All right, sure.
The Sandlot.
Never seen it.
That movie is dope. That movie is so funny and so cool. It's from the early 90s. It's a kid movie.
Yeah,
they just
90s. Had like a 20th anniversary yeah. of Blu-ray.
That's where You're Killing Me Smalls comes from.
Oh.
Yeah. Every time I say that to you, you say... What are you talking about? And I have to explain. It's from The Sandlot.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
All three Toy Stories.
Sure.
Django Unchained.
Mm-hmm.
Inglourious Bastards.
Yeah.
She says, as a side note, Eli Roth is really hot in this movie. Especially that scene when he comes out of the tunnel.
The Bear Jew.
When he's the Bear Jew, yeah. I have no idea why she has listed this first film. The first Pokemon movie. She writes, I love Pokemon, and there is only one sentence to describe this movie. Two Pikachu slapping each other in the face while crying because they are forced to fight each other to the death. To the death. This is a kid's movie.
Yeah, we definitely get
that is what happens.
Lion King.
Yeah. The Color Purple.
Yeah.
Diary of a Mad Black Woman.
Oh.
Girl, no. No. And Forrest Gump, double
no,
gump.
No.
I'll sit through Die of a Mad Black Woman twice. So that's the letter. Thank you, Maria.
Yes.
We love that you love the show. We love your list, except for the things that we hate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Take a letter, Maria. Address it to my wife.
That's an old reference.
Yes, well. Didn't some country duo cover it?
No. Brooks and Dunn covered My Maria.
Right, but I thought somebody else covered Take a Letter.
Oh, maybe they did. Who knows?
Take an email, Maria. All right. Well, we thank you for listening. And once again, we wanted to remind you to check out our friends in the podcast universe. The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli. Cooking with Malcolm Ingram. Fat Guys at the Movies. The Criterion Cast. Throwing Shade. And they're going on tour soon. So if you have been listening to the show and you are living somewhere that is not L.A., they may be... Come into your town, as the monkeys used to say. So check them out. Team Jack, on whom we will be appearing soon.
You're full of Gen X today, aren't you?
I guess.
Yeah.
Monkeys are boomers. They only became Gen X when they got reran on MTV.
Doesn't matter.
Anyway, Team Jack, which Dave and I will be guest appearing on very soon, and we'll let you know about that.
Isn't it already up?
I haven't seen it. He hasn't emailed me or anything.
Oh, really?
I haven't looked.
We recorded it last week.
Yes, but his stuff doesn't always necessarily pop up.
Oh, I see.
The Schmoes Know, the B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this program for free at iTunes, and if you want to leave us a review there, that would be swell. You can stream the show at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com, or there's some Android app that does it too, but I don't remember the name of it offhand. Please like our Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can check into the program at GetGlue.com, and drop us an email.
You should like our Facebook page. To the exclusion of liking other podcasts. I'll say that. How's that?
And drop us an email. Drop us an email at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Send us your...
I'm getting competitive out
here. Yeah, fine. Send us your top 10, your bottom 10, your anything, questions, comments, anything you want. We would love to hear from you.
Yeah.
And next week, Star Trek Into Darkness and...
Francis Ha.
And Francis Ha. I can't wait to talk about Francis Ha. So anyway, we'll catch you next time.
There was something else I was going to say. I guess I forgot what it was. The minute these microphones go off, I'm going to be like, oh, yeah, that. Oh, wait. Well, I just remembered it. Uh-huh. We were just on Sirius.
Out Q
on the Derek and Romaine show.
Yes.
And apparently, we're going to be on once a month?
Well,
is that what's going to happen?
It's a possibility.
I thought if that was happening.
Maybe it's not. It's sort of like with the guy.
If we do a good job.
It's like the British soldier in a Dell H. It was discussed, but not confirmed.
So if we already haven't worn out our welcome.
Yes.
We'll be back.
And any of you guys who are fans of Derek and Romaine, you know, might just mention on Twitter or Facebook how much you love us and how much you want to hear us on the show more. It couldn't hurt.
I was under the impression that this was already a done deal, but it might not be.
Let's not take anything for granted.
Okay. Well, if we know we're going to be back on, we'll let you know in advance this time.
Yes. Oh, and in the meantime, in addition to what the... I keep forgetting to mention on the show. In addition to What the Flick, doing the weekly movie stuff, I'm also now doing weekly Mad Men recaps. So if you are a fan of that show, those get posted every, I think, Monday evening. Right. So check it out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Goodbye.